This is the GamesRegie.biz microcast for Monday, the 22nd of April 2024, recorded on Friday, the 19th of April 2024. I'm James Batchelor, Editor-in-Chief of GamesRegie.biz. I am joined, as always, by Christopher Dring, Head of GamesRegie.biz.
Hello.
He's waving. There you go. If you're not on YouTube, he waved. And we are joined by special guest, founder of Skillful, Gina Jackson. Gina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Really appreciate you joining us. You're going to be helping us talk through one of the biggest stories of the past week. Before we do, Chris, how was your week? Are you recovered from post-BAFTA? Have you been up to anything fun this week?
I went to see A Secret Building in Rare, my favourite games developer.
Of course you did. How many times have you been to Rare now?
I don't know. I'm hoping at one point I just end up getting a desk.
Hot desking in Twycross, that'd be marvellous.
They've opened a brand new, actually they opened it 12 months ago, but they're sort of revealing it now. They've got a brand new, very sustainable barn that they've actually moved most of their development team into. It's double the size of it. So Rare are like in a farmyard. It's a beautiful place to work. So they're in the middle of a farmyard, surrounded by fields and trees and walks and all that kind of stuff, which they all own the grounds of. And they've just but the barns were built 20 years ago when games were quite different. So they've now built a new structure. They've got the Everwild team in there and the Sea of Thieves team in there and that sort of stuff. And they're using the other barns for other things. Some of it's like well-being and training and learning, and some of it's like secret stuff. I was trying to break in, it's called Barn X. But it's also fully it's a full timber barn. It's made the type of wood that you can even when it's supposed to, it's designed to last 60 years. And that after 60 years, you can just take it down. You don't need to knock it down. You can just sort of, it feels like they've built a solar farm as well outside. So it's all part powered by the sun. And it's a very sustainable, it's part of Microsoft's sort of sustainability promises. They've built it around all of that. And it's a really cool building. There's an article on Games and Stoppers today all about it, which is, it's really quite a nice little visit. I had a lot of fun. It's nice there.
Good stuff. Yes, absolutely. As Chris says, like, please do go to GI and read the full article. Going to dive into some of the biggest stories of the past week. We're going to start with Gina. You published a report on Thursday, the UK Skills Crisis report. Report on the. Hang on, I'll find the exact title of it here because I did actually do my research. The skills crisis in the UK games sector. There we go. I do know what I'm doing, I promise. I found this really interesting. So this talks to like a much, much broader kind of topic, which we're going to dive into. Obviously, the report itself is specifically focused on the UK sector. But I feel like a lot of this kind of applies to a number of markets. The kind of the very, very short TLDR, and I'm sure you can correct me if I'm oversimplifying this, but it is that not just that there's a skills crisis, that there are systemic issues causing this skills crisis, and that among the recommendations you've suggested setting up an industry-led skills body that can kind of identify and tackle the biggest problems, but there's a real lack of consensus as to who funds and organises that organisation. Like the suggestions among the stakeholders you spoke to were like, we should be funded by government or the Creative Industries Council, or it should be funded by the industry itself. Kind of want to talk a bit larger about the skills crisis itself. Like, I don't even know where to start. Like,
what is the skills crisis?
Well, that would be a good start. Yes,
I mean, I know we all know, but let's
start there. Yeah,
yeah, and God, you've stumped me slightly because I was going to go into the detail, but I think that's the point of the whole report, is that it's not about the detail, it's about we've never had the conversation about who's responsible for skills and who's responsible for our talent pipeline. And I think it's really easy for us to say it's not us, because that's what everyone else needs to run around and do, because we're here to make the games, we're the crafty people, we make the magic. But actually we're a whole ecosystem, and it doesn't just happen by magic in the way that games happen by magic when you create them and people come and play. And we are growing up, we're maturing as an industry, we've been around for, 30, 40 years. But we just still seem to think that we don't need all this stuff around us to make everything work. So this is what the report originally was supposed to just look at the tiny bits of where we're missing skills, technical artists coming through, do we need more of them? But as I dig deeper and deeper into it, I suddenly went, well, hang on, I'm coming up with all these different recommendations, but are they just going to sit on a shelf in a report that I wrote? Or shall I try and find out who's actually going to do them, or who wants to do them, or who could do them? And then that's when I began to talk to people, and they went, don't know. And if anyone wants to try that out, the questions are all at the end. Go and ask yourself those questions and say, who do you expect to go and find the programmers or bring people in who've got those programming skills? And everyone just goes, oh, don't know. So that's what it's all about.
My reading of the results were there's kind of two skills crisis going on. Like there's so the report identifies that there's a senior to mid-level skills crisis in that most of the jobs advertised are for senior to mid-level employees. Although, as you kind of point out in the report, there's kind of a lack of consensus as to what senior to mid-level means. They can mean different things in different companies, and so there's that. There's like, you know, most of the jobs advertised are for experienced talent, but then there's also the fact there are so few jobs for junior and entry level positions. And like Colin McDonald from Games Job Live, which I think you use most of their data for this report, he did a talk at the London Developer Conference last week, and I think he said like over the course of a year, or certainly in one given month, there are only 27 entry level positions advertised in London, and London's producing 3,500 graduates per year.
Colin did say to me once that a lot of entry-level jobs aren't even advertised. Like, there might be more.
I did wonder that.
There might be more than that out there. Yeah. They're not put up front. I have actually, this is a really passionate thing for me, even though it's a long time ago now. I've been in the industry about, my brother is 10 years younger than me. So when he came out of university, he was at university, they did 2 year course, then you had a year in industry, then you had a final year of his course. And he wanted to work in video games. He did computer science or something at Bath University. So I went, right, I'll go and see if I can find someone that did an internship. And I went to some of the biggest studios that I could think of. I went to Frontier and Rebellion and stuff like that. This is a while ago now. I think they do it now. None of them did internships. None of them did any form of like student outreach. And they always went, oh yeah, we probably should. he eventually himself got on the Microsoft scheme, and he's got into the industry, and he's now worked at Sumo. He's at Playground now, working on Fable, and he's got in that way. But at that moment I went, oh, we really aren't doing our bit, right? Mm. And then there was the Games Education Summit, which ran for a few years, which was incredible. I've never been to a conference where there's two groups targeted at two groups of people that kind of hate each other. Like, they were just, you had the educators that were furious with the games industry for not doing enough to, you know, help their students get into the industry and learn about the industry and stuff like that, and not, you know, reach out to them and work with them. And then you had the industry that hated the educators for not preparing their students properly for what was to come in the games industry. And it was a really useful event, actually, because I think it stopped after a few years, but it really seemed like the two of them were properly going for each other. Some of the panels were really hostile, and I've never seen anything like it, actually. It's definitely a problem, but there's never really been a, I think the BGI for a bit was like wanted to be the solution for it, but
there is no one in the middle translating. So we as an industry assume that educators know what we want, but we don't ever tell them. And we don't say, what are our future skills and what are our problems now, and can you solve them through education? I don't think we have any empathy for education, who have to do things on a individual basis. But then we say, particularly for development, we need people who can work in teams and multidisciplinary teams. And that's quite hard for education to do when they do single subjects of how to put people in teams. I've just done a boot camp with Game Republic, and it's a graduate training program where we give people the experience to work in multidisciplinary groups. And we've had great support. Avalanche gave us a whole bunch of concept art, and we did an AI project with them, and they came back and gave us their views on it. And then with Singer Studio, they gave me some source code, and we optimized code. And it's not glamorous optimization, but it's crucial. And these guys got experience, and now they're getting jobs on the back of it because they've got the experience piece as well as the skills piece. So we need to work it out, but we can't do it in that way of there's those over there, the educators, and us on this side. But there's also senior staff that we need to train up. We need to get rid of these barriers, or if we can't get rid of the barriers, get translators in those barriers going, right, I'll take all the needs of the industry, and then I'll push it over there, and then they can come back with the solutions, and I'll take it back. It doesn't need to be, you know, 100 people. It needs to be 2 or 3. People who were just doing this translation, this collation, and this making it work. None of the solutions I've put in the report are difficult. mainly because I'm not that bright. I've just come up with practical, simple solutions that we can just do at fairly low cost. There's loads of funding out there in the UK, and I'm sure there is in the rest of the world to do it. And people really want to help us. We're just not very good at using it. Mainly, I think, because everyone just wants to make games. No one wants to do the bits on the periphery.
Gina, you were going to call us out on something you said last week on the podcast where we talked
I wasn't going to call you out. I was simply going to have a comment.
You are now.
I mean it in a positive way. Which was around something we said about how, you know, you lose institutional knowledge, and it's about but it was actually in a way arguing against the idea that in the future game studios might actually be a bunch of contractors and a bunch of people who are brought together to work on a project and they split apart, but the way it is in film and in other industries. Does that make this skills problem even more acute if that is the direction that we're heading in, do you think? Or is that...
No, I think it gives us a simpler template. We've got the template of film, and film are really good at training their people. And productions understand that they need to pay into a training levy, and that's part of their responsibility because they all dip into this freelancer pool. So I think they have greater responsibility for their skills pipeline because they need that whole pool that everyone shares, and they understand it. Because we have a need to own our talent, I think we don't see it as a shared responsibility. We see it as an individual responsibility, and that's the difference. But I think working as a freelancer is different to working as an employed person, and I thought I needed the stability in my career to be employed, and now basically I'm a contractor and I'm trying to set up another business, and I find that I'm not particularly comfortable with that insecurity, and I like being looked after and I like having all those benefits. And I think there's different stages of your career or different kinds of people. And if we are moving to a contractor model, which would make sense because we do grow and reduce, particularly development teams, but even publishers in times are going to grow and develop depending on how many games they've got coming out, then that model works better than this boom and bust that we're going through. Boom and bust is really uncomfortable. But if we're going to go up and down anyway, then contracting is a simple way of making that happen.
Yeah, it's interesting. People actually were saying to me, like, the industry always does this over time. I think the reason why it feels so, like, the reason why it is so extreme right now is we went particularly big, during that period of boom.
22.65% across 213 companies, if you want the exact figure.
Is that how much?
Love exact figures.
is that how much the companies grew by?
Yeah.
So that doesn't include all the sheer number of startups that sort of happened during that period.
I managed to go through the accounts of 213 companies and draw out how their workforce had changed in that time.
Yeah, so that doesn't even talk about how the industry overall grew. That's just specifically the companies.
That's just in the UK and 213 companies.
Wow.
It's the wider impact that's having on the whole industry. Like I say this because I finally wrote up. I spoke to Kim Parker Adcock from OPM earlier this year, shortly after the company closed. I finally ran that article yesterday. And she was talking about how, the industry grew, massively in the lockdown kind of, boom, the massive surge of money that came into the industry. Loads of people were expanding. She said, like, there were points where we were like trying to find 500 people for certain companies and so forth. Like, companies were growing huge, and it was the biggest high we've ever seen, like that she's ever seen. She'd been running her business for like 26 years. OPM had survived like the 2008 recession, the dot-com bubble crash, like all those. But this one like created such a high that the vacuum it's left behind has just completely scuppered kind of like the whole recruitment space, to the point where OPM kind of limped through 2023. Okay, it was still kind of placing some people, but they were saying that it got to like, they basically were waiting on clients to say when they would need more people to hire. And it got to January and everyone was saying, oh, maybe April, maybe July. And Kim was like, if you're guessing that you're going to be start hiring again in July, then you don't know. And the idea of 6 months without, at least 6 months without needing to hire anyone else because you're going to be cutting down and making downsizing. Then the layoffs we've seen have been insane. we were having this conversation, Gina, like earlier this week when I actually saw you and you presented the report. Like, I said, like, it kind of feels like this is the worst cycle of layoffs we've ever seen, the worst bust following boom. You, I think you disagreed or rather questioned me. Not well, disagreed,
no,
but questioned me.
Just, we don't know.
We don't know. That's true. No, we don't.
We've got no data.
No.
I mean, I was laid off in 2000 when I was at Ocean.
Yeah.
And that felt bad. And that's where the industry in Manchester in particular just closed down overnight and I had to move to London. A regret I continue to have, but there we go. I'm here. I can't move now. But it felt so impactful when Infogrames came in. They bought all those companies and then they closed again. It doesn't feel unlike the Embracer story.
No.
But these cycles and this damage continues. And I still remember how that feels. And I've been through a lot of redundancies in this boom and bust cycle that we go through. So surely we now have to sit back and say, hang on, we can't keep damaging people like this.
Yeah.
We need a better way of doing this. But that means we need to step back and look at all the infrastructure around us and what we can do and how we make that better, not just the making game stuff that's really exciting.
I thought that was a really important message around your report, like, because when I was writing it up, Marie D'Alessandri, our deputy editor, was like kind of proofing the article for me. She's like, this is all 2022 data, like, why are we talking about this now? And you addressed this at the start of your talk at the Games Impact Summit, talking about, like, why am I talking about this now? You know, 18,000 people laid off in the last year and a bit. Why am I talking about 2022 job vacancies now? But you're right, it's because, like, we need to understand, like, why we have these boom and bust cycles and how we can prevent them to stop this from happening again. Like,
but to go back to Kim's comment, like, we were taking on loads and loads of people. We couldn't find enough people. Anecdotally, recruiters were telling me that they were offering 30-40k for people to stay where they were because they didn't want to lose people, right? And that hits your bottom line. And I think some of those layoffs.
Similarly, Kim said that applicants they were helping were being offered 10 to 20k more than they would have normally. Like, the money being thrown at staff was insane.
This is the
but
stuff
we don't throw saying. That at the talent pipeline to solve.
No.
We throw no money at that. Mm. We just say, oh, we'll buy our way out of this problem. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, it caused a problem because then we had that, obviously everyone overspent, you know, everyone's budgets went up during the pandemic for this very reason that we're talking about, where everyone started having to raise their wages, having to increase their benefits, or having to just make themselves a better place to work in a good, some of that was good. But then when Russia invaded Ukraine and the cost of living went up, everyone had to raise their wages again and the cost of business went up again. And it was like, the first time was our fault. Second time we had little control over that, but it's sort of that. Those are the costs that drove that. The other thing that something that Steve Ellis said in our interview when we talked about the collapse of the second Free Radical Design and Embracer closing that studio is that studio was full of he has the approach of just bringing in kids, right? He has like 3-4 senior people and the rest of it is young people that he brings into his studios. It's what he did Free Radical Design, and he was terrified about what was going on because he was worried that it's the young people at the minute that can't get in now because there's a lot of senior staff that are, you know, that are looking for work. So it's the, and I went to a Game Republic event, you know, in Leeds in January, and there were two students saying, well, I'm in my final year of university and I'm looking into, I'm starting to do networking and trying to find work in the games industry. And I didn't know what to say to them, right? You know, I just thought, it's the worst time, right? It is the, you're fighting against people who've been doing it for, who are looking for work now, who have been out in the market several years. But, go on.
But there are ways around it. Right. So we do have funds in the UK that can help you do startups. Mm-hmm. And it's easier to do a startup when you're young than when you've got family and responsibilities. So if you don't have a choice, go and do that. And there's lots of ways of supporting that. So whether you're looking at Transfuser, whether you're looking at Prototype Fund, those things exist. There was another fund that came out this week. But also there's loads of local authorities that are looking to get into games. So we're doing a whole bunch of stuff in York and North Yorkshire around that. But also you can go adjunct. We had an amazing woman who was on our course who's gone to work at a furniture company making 3D models. Right. So she's going to have a portfolio of amazing furniture that she can then put in Engine. And I've said, just make packs as well that can go into Unity and you can flog the furniture too.
Yeah.
But she's gone a kind of roundabout route to get in. So her skills are still increasing. The goal is still there. She's still getting closer. But she's just gone a slightly different route.
That's the answer I'll give next time.
Make furniture packs.
But I think you've just got to be a bit cleverer. Yeah. But we all know, you know, whenever you get put in a situation where you get constricted with what you can do, you come up with the best ideas. If you can just do anything or go anywhere, then it feels a bit overwhelming. So I think this is a time where we're going to see amazing stuff. And I was lucky enough to be on, I was on a panel last night at the Bank of England. It's just one of those crazy world moments. You're thinking, why am I in the briefing room of Bank of England talking about games? But I was next to Hilda from CCP, and he was talking about the EVE Online community and the stuff they were doing and the stuff they never imagined was going to happen in that community. Mm. And we talked about where games was and all the things that we can do about games. And we all agreed that we just scratched the surface. So maybe this is the time where we explode into all those other areas. And you were talking about older people playing games and coming in to play Skyrim out of nowhere on last week's podcast. And I'm like, those are the people. Now's the time where we can be cleverer and do other things. Yeah. Because the normal way is being blocked by, you know, 6-year-old games that we think everyone's playing.
Yeah. Or in the case of this week, 9-year-old games, because it's Fallout 4 that's top of the charts.
Yes. Well, let's talk about that. Slight tangent and beautiful segue there, Chris. Thank you very much. Because this is kind of showing you like how successful game brands can be kind of beyond the game space. The Fallout TV series on Amazon Prime. I'll be honest, I haven't watched it yet, but the vast majority of the GI team is watching it and is telling me it's amazing. So clearly that's something I'm going to have to do this weekend. We've seen adaptations like, you know, increasingly over the last few years. We've obviously seen the Mario movie, the Sonic movies, the Last of Us TV show. I don't recall seeing games getting quite as much of a boost. So Chris, you kind of did the story, so I'll let you kind of give the stats. But yeah, Fallout's kind of taken over Europe over the last week.
Yeah, it's different. It's, actually, I find it quite interesting. And Gina, you've come from you've worked for some publishers before. I'd be interested to know actually, because with The Last of Us, Sony released a Last of Us Part 1 remaster like 3 or 4 months before the TV show, but then they didn't really do anything to promote The Last of Us games when the TV show launched. The TV show did boost the game sales, but not. It was also a different. It came out every week, that show, rather than all in one go like Fallout has. But it had a uptick, but Sony didn't do any particular promotion around it. They didn't do any. Some people call me out and say, actually, they did a few tweets or whatever, but it was nothing a significant activity. Mm. When the Mario movie happened, Nintendo released a bundle, a new Mario bundle with. They even did a new, I think, a red Switch and everything like that to try and get people into the Switch ecosystem using the Mario movie. They put some Mario games with it. It's different in different countries what they did. And I actually see why Nintendo did that, because then 5 months later, we didn't know that at the time, but 5 months later, they launched Super Mario Wonder, and that became a very big, big hit at Christmas. Mario games always do well, obviously, but it felt to me like they were bringing in new users and getting people into the sort of Mario was the big thing for them, so they had this big launch. With Fallout, what they've done is Fallout's a little different. For starters, Fallout 4 and Fallout 76, the last two Fallout games, are both on the PlayStation Plus Extra tier, so you can subscribe to it. It's also on Xbox Game Pass. Xbox Game Pass has all the Fallout games on it. There's also on Amazon Luna. So you can stream that stuff. So there's actually ways to access these games quite cheaply. But rather than use the TV show purely to push people into subscribing or whatever, they actually heavily discounted those games. So those games have been, you know, they did a big Fallout sale and promotion around the TV show. And the game's number one in Europe, by the way, and by quite a big margin. But the revenue is going to be it's not going to be particularly big, because the price of the game is just a couple of pounds. And I just think it's fascinating. They're clearly treating it as a big brand-building moment for Fallout, get people from the TV show to play the games. I assume there might be something coming, then. That's my guess, that they're sort of trying to build up the audience for something.
I swear I've read that they've said Fallout 5 is not coming until after Elder Scrolls 6.
Yeah, but there was a leak of a release date around Fallout 3 remaster or something. So it doesn't have to be a full new Fallout. But it just, for me, it was a very interesting strategy to try. And you've got the big TV show, and you've heavily discounted the games. You've managed to get people who watch the TV show to go to the games, or some of them. That and I'm assuming there's a strategy there that we don't know yet. We don't know what the next beat is. Whereas Sony sort of went pretty muted on it, and Nintendo sort of used it to push hardware. It's always different. It's different, you know. In the books, they just do a major motion picture and put it at the front of Waterstones. Right? Yeah. It's done very, very well, and it's great to see. It's just, we live in an industry now where a 9-year-old game is top of the charts. You imagine that in 2014 or whatever.
But don't you think it's interesting that TV and film are now looking at us?
Yeah.
And I don't think they're... I think they're in their own world of pain with streaming services and lack of advertisers and things. So they're looking at us to hook into the communities that we've already got. I think they're being quite smart, and I think it's taken that of them being in trouble to really take us seriously and understand the kind of sales potential that we can bring to them.
They run out of comics.
And books.
I think it's more than that, though. I think they realise that people don't watch, that we have an audience that are more experimental in how they consume their data or how they consume their entertainment, and that's what they want to hook into. They won't really admit it, and they won't admire us from afar, but I think they'll hook in and work with us for commercial gain.
I guess to an extent, they're tapping into an audience, they're tapping into an established audience that they can bring over, but they're also tapping into established audiences that are almost, not starved, but certainly hungry for content. You joke about, they've run out of comics. Any Spider-Man fan doesn't need to desperately go see the Spider-Man movie because there's a new Spider-Man every month. There's a new Spider-Man comic every month. There's not a new Fallout game every... There's a new Fallout game every 5 to 6 years. That's a small element, I guess, but it just means that there's an appetite. There's an appetite among games communities that you perhaps don't find among other forms of entertainment. Yeah.
That's the way of keeping brands alive in between.
But who do you think is watching the TV show then?
My team at the moment.
Pardon? But is it people that are coming to it new, like The Last of Us, and then they were going to the game? Or is it the other way around? Is it both?
I imagine it's a mix of both. Anecdotally, I've heard more about Fallout from people who play the games.
We live in the world.
I recognise I'm in that echo bubble, but then I do recall, when The Last of Us came out, I do recall hearing people that are nothing to do with games at all saying, I've been watching that, The Last of Us, it's really good. Are the games any good?
Yeah.
But doesn't the sales figures show us that, was it based on the number of units or on the revenue? Units.
Yeah.
So it's a whole new audience coming across that.
Yeah. So we are seeing... I think it's definitely a new audience. Look, it's the thing is, this stuff has also been done more seriously. I remember, back in the old days when it was a video game adaptation, it was often done by someone you've ever heard of before, and it was entirely handled by the movie production studio. This one is done by Jonathan Nolan, the person behind Westworld and Person of Interest, and Lisa Joy and those sort of teams. And it's got Todd Howard is an executive producer on it, right? So it's we are involved. That's the other thing as well. Comic book movies started doing really well. It was actually the Marvel itself that went, we'll make these now. Okay, thank you. And Nintendo is the co-financer and producers of the Mario movie. They didn't just farm it off to Illumination and say, you do it all.
That's because they remember what happened in 1993.
And The Last of Us, it's Neil Druckmann's one of the producers of that show as well, and it's sort of
the Borderlands movie that's coming out. That's actually Gearbox has a film studio unit that's taking the lead on that.
Ubisoft Motion Pictures does. I mean, I know it hasn't quite worked out for them. They haven't quite had a hit yet, unless you count Mythic Quest on Apple, but which isn't based on any game. But they've not quite had anything yet. But they've also launched their own motion pictures division. I don't know if it's quite. We're getting involved because we see it as an opportunity to unlock audiences, right? And a way to keep our brands alive in between these big gaps between things. It's definitely an opportunity for the games industry, but it's also, as Gina says, the film industry's desperate for stuff to get people to watch and get people back into the cinemas and get people subscribing and get them engaged in their stuff. And games is so huge. You know, was it Bob Iger who said, this games thing's quite big, isn't it? A couple of months ago, right? I didn't notice. And I'm like, oh, thanks, Bob. Well, welcome to, you know, 15 years ago. But it says a lot. Like, they are definitely opened their eyes to it. Yeah. But I'm not quite sure what we're talking about now. TV shows. Did we finish off talking about skills, by the way? I sort of segued us into
you that. You segued us. I mean, I think the skills conversation is kind of ongoing. I mean, I'm happy to pick up that conversation again, but we could be going for another hour or so. I mean, I guess final words to Gina then, like, because I'm very conscious that we're breaching the limits of micro once again. What's the next step of this? Like, you know, you've produced the report, you've made the recommendations, like, either what needs to happen next or what would you like to see happen next in terms of actually sitting, the industry actually taking action and dealing with this issue?
It's already happening. I'm getting emails now from companies saying, we want to be involved in this. How do we solve the problem? We just need more. And they need to come with some money too. Because we've got a choice. Either we do it or we don't do it. And we can't keep sitting in this area in the middle of, well, maybe, perhaps, I'll wait someone else to do it. I'll buy myself out of it if I have to. It's time to step up. Or not, and we can all go away and do something else.
It used to be one of my biggest frustrations when we did the career fair, and we always get all the universities would come and book booths around the career fair, and we'd go to the game developers and say, hey, do you want to book booths at the career fair? And no, we're not really interested in young people. We get plenty of those applicants. And I said, well, it's not just about that. It's about talking to them, speaking to them, and pointing them in the direction, and all this kind of stuff. It's just my sales team. I don't make these pitches. And we'd get a couple. You'd get like Rebellion and Creative Assembly going through their own stuff at the minute. But you'd get those companies that are that would come every year, and they would say, like, we invest in it now. We know we're not going to get necessarily many jobs directly from this, but we know that maybe in 3 or 4 years we will. And that's the, and they were very much, it's all about the long term gain. But it was just so few companies were thinking about it and even saying those things.
Yeah, I mean, the Legacy project has been incredible at Creative Assembly. And I'd love to see that carry on. Sony do the partnership with Prince's Trust. The impact of that on young people, either into the industry or in general, and the power of games to change how people perceive themselves and the confidence they have and their ability to make games and to be seen by a company like PlayStation. It's off the scale. I think we sometimes forget that we're a dream industry for many people and that we can use the power of that to change people and how they perceive themselves. We've done that with mental health. We can do it with young people and confidence and loneliness and all sorts of different areas. We're really powerful if we put our minds to it.
I'm going to wrap us up on that motivational note there. That's superb. Gina, can you come and do this every week? Gina, thank you so, so much for your time today. Really, really do appreciate it.
No, thank you for all your support.
No worries at all. Chris, thank you for turning up as well.
Anytime.
Good. That is it for this week. We'll be back next Monday with the next microcast. In the meantime, please do check out our website, gamesindustry.biz. That's where you get all the news, insight, and analysis of the world behind video games. And if you need more, if you need news delivered to your inbox every single day, be sure to sign up to the GI Daily. This is our daily newsletter. It gives you the big stories of every day, a little slice of history with something that happened on that day in games in the past. It's a great way to kind of digest that everything we're working on, so you can sign up for that at gamesindustry.biz/newsletters. There's links and stuff down here as well, and one will appear magically when the video ends if you're watching on YouTube. I'm pointing and I'm realizing that, like, more people are still listening to this as a podcast than they are doing it as a video, but the link is in the episode description as well. I'm rambling. We're gonna go. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll be back next Monday.